Okay, so I just want to begin by welcoming our brothers. Thanks, guys, for taking the time, taking an hour, hour and a half to just meet with these guys. One of the things that often comes up as we're going through training is, you know, it's great to study the Westminster Confession of Faith and BCO and all that stuff, but tell me what you really do, you know? That's what guys are often eager to hear about. So let's just start this way. I'm going to have a few questions, but then I want to open it up to the rest of you and allow you guys to ask questions. But let's begin this way. Just share with the guys your name, something about your family, occupation, how long you've been at Christ Covenant, and then how long you've been either an elder or a deacon. Okay?
Yep.
So Matt, you want to start?
I am Matt Lindner. I am married to Leslie. We have four kids. Two of them are in college, and two are about to go to college. So we're sending them all out. I've been a member here since 1994. So I came straight from college, joined right after that, and then I felt the call about a year before, well, about 6 months before, kind of internally before Rich, who. Which we've known a long time. He called me one day and asked if I would stand for the officer training. So that was the end of 2020, and then took the class in the spring of 21, so 2 years ago. So I've been on, I'm an elder. I've been on the session since 2021.
Great. Jason?
Jason Poston. I have been a member here since 2003. My wife and I, I've both been members since 2003, have two kids. One is at CDS in middle school, and the other one is going to CPCC right now, doing a dual enrollment class. He's 17. My wife works part-time at the church also, so you'll get emails from her more and more as you get more involved with things. She helps a lot of people stay on top of a lot of different things here. I have been an officer since 2011 here. And I'm currently the chair of the diaconate this year.
Jeremy Wanamaker. My wife and I have been attending since 2015, became members in 2017, became a deacon in 2019, so it's my fourth year on the diaconate. We have four kids, ranging from 10 to 3. Our oldest two will be going to CDS next year, so we're excited about that. We've been homeschooling. Excited to get the older two into Covenant Day. And my occupation, I'm a IT, I own an IT company. Run that.
Great, I'm Will Ertl. I started attending in 1993, straight from college. I met my wife in the singles group, where Mike Miller was the singles pastor. Before he left and came back to be the missions pastor. So that's 30 years.
You're old.
Wow. Yeah, I'm a financial planner, and I have three marvelous adult children. They're 25, 23, and 21. And one interesting fact about my wife is her father, Mo, who often will sit with us Sunday morning, signed the original PCA charter in 1973 in Birmingham, Alabama. So the ties in Debbie's family for the PCA go right to the genesis, right to the very beginning. So, but if you get a chance to meet Mo, he's delightful. You ought to speak to him.
And how long have you been an elder?
I'm sorry, I've been an elder for 4 years.
What's his last name?
Mo Updegraff.
Yeah.
His wife Janie, Mo and Janie. So, but 4 years as an elder, so I get sabbatical here in a couple months.
You have a smile on your face.
I've been sabbatical a couple months.
So. All right.
Tom, really quickly for us,
yeah.
Can we go around the room? Just
sure.
I've met a few already.
Sure. My name's Matt. Me and my wife, we have two children, and a 4-year-old, 2-year-old, and we've been coming to Christ Covenant for 3.5 years now. We moved from Korea, so that was kind of a big move. But like I said, job, I just... we'll start tomorrow in the IT company. So,
the elder or deacon candidate?
Deacon.
Okay.
Andrew Cash. I'm a deacon candidate, married to Sarah. I have a 6 and a 4-year-old, Walker and Elsie. I work for one of the banks downtown. We both came to Christ Covenant originally in 2011, 2010 with Campus Outreach, moved away, became members again when we moved back in 2017.
Yeah, I'm Ben Trainer, Pastor Linter, neither deacon nor elder candidate, just here to learn and observe, and then be invited to just see what's going on, teach a little, see some of the process, and what it is to take some of what I've seen and learn to recontextualize it in the future.
Terry Dixon, been coming here since 1996. I think our membership class might have led over into 97, but our first Sunday here was the last Sunday in the gym. That's always stood out. So all three of our kids went to and graduated from Covenant Day. And you may know my wife, Susan. She's been here all over. So.
Elder or deacon?
I was nominated for deacon.
Undecided.
I mean, for I'm still weighing that.
Only to know the context of the questions, right, and where they're going.
Okay. Beecher Bailey. We've been coming here about 7 years. My wife is Ann. I have a 31-year-old, and the other two are in college right now. I got a call from one of your colleagues, one of the elders, a couple months back. He said, look, I want you to know I nominated you for elder, Bill Hedgepeth. So I got off the phone. I went and said, hey, Ann, Bill Hedgepeth just called and said he nominated me for elder. She said, yeah, I did too. So, appreciate that vote of confidence.
Necessary.
Lane Jones is an elder candidate. I have 4 daughters and 1 son-in-law as of about 14 months ago. I'm in real estate and originally became a member in 1983. So, went for college and worked a little bit and then returned here in late.
John White, married to my wife Marjorie. We have been at Christ Covenant Church a long time. I started here not exactly right out of college, but in my early 20s in 1987. So we got me beat on the time frame. But I was nominated by Brent Anderson and Roger Paulus, Brent for deacon and Roger for elder. And I'm still, I know I'm not going to be an elder.
Rich Petrus, 4 kids, 11 grandkids, retired, deacon candidate, and been here at Christ Covenant about 33 years. Matt, you and I met a lot of years ago before you were even married at a Harry Reader Bible study.
At a non-existent Shoney's.
That's right.
That's no longer there. Yeah. Shoney's might not even have any. Remaining.
Yeah. John Gerard, been a member here for 5 years. Nominated as a deacon. I have 4 children. Married to my wife Kara for 30 years. And I think that's it.
I'm Chuck Marzon, elder candidate. Married to Carol for 47 years. We were 40 plus years in Virginia Beach. Moved here the day before the lockdown, and I was originally ordained as a BC USA elder in the late 90s, I think it was, and it's been a journey to get to the BCA, so I'm looking forward to that.
Remember, it took 40 years for the Israelites to get through the lockdown.
I'm aware.
Hey, I'm Drew Gusterson. I'm a deacon candidate. I've been a member here since 2014, but started attending here in 2016. I was on staff at Campus Outreach, so went to a PCA church up in Mooresville for a short while. Came down here, met my wife, Michelle, many of you know her as Mish, and we have 1 son that will be a member too.
And Mark Childa, my wife Judy and I have been coming here since middle of 2020. Moved right in the midst of the COVID pandemic, so it was probably 6 months before we actually physically came to church. We've been members since. kids, Mark and Elizabeth, who are 15 and 12, respectively. I'm a banker, and I've been nominated for the office of the community.
Excellent. All right, so guys, this is a question for all of you. I won't, determine who goes. You just go as you want to, but just tell us what an average month is like for you in terms of your office. So, speak either as an elder or deacon. What does an average month look like? What are your responsibilities? What do you get involved with? Give us details.
All right. I would say, first of all, a lot of study of the Word, right? Because it is a very, for me, it was a very sobering call. And to accept it, I felt like Moses and, I don't think I can do this. And then I was kind of like King Saul hiding in the baggage, I'm not sure that I really want. So I felt I really had to throw myself into the Word because I didn't feel like I had the power to do it on my own. So I read a lot. I study a lot. Just thinking, I don't know what's coming next. I can't really plan for it. Second thing I'm doing is trying to just stay in touch with folks. And a lot of it is just preemptive type things. So I'm an elder, so I'm trying to know the folks. So this book, I think you gave them the Whitmer book, right? And he's got four categories: know, feed, lead, teach. And so I'm still, even 2 years now, getting to know the folks well enough that we're, there's a trust relationship there. It takes a while to build a trust relationship in a commuter church where people are coming and going. You're not in a neighborhood with them. So a lot of it's that. And then depending on the season, this week I had a communicant interview. First of all, your family is your own shepherding group, so being with your family. I have a member whose mother is in toward hospice. Met with a single guy who is dating his first girlfriend. So it's all over the place, and you just don't know what's coming next. So there's a lot of prayer. There's a lot of talking with folks. Hey, how would you do this? How would you start off? A lot of leaning on other guys. But mostly it's filling myself up so that I have something to offer, right? And reading a lot.
So my week is maybe a little bit different than the general diaconate, because as the chair, I have some additional responsibilities I kind of represent the diaconate between the diaconate and the session and the ELT, which is a subset of the session that makes some higher level decisions for the church. So I do have some additional meetings and calls and things that I participate in. And I'm responsible for leading our deacon meetings whenever we get together, which is about 4 or 5 times a year. But generally, the deacons meet every 2 or 3 times that we have a session meeting. And then the other times that we have a joint session meeting, the deacons will just meet along with the elders after the general business part, and we'll do some shepherding work together. My particular shepherding group that I am responsible for is aligned with one of the elders here, Ross Wilson, and our group is fairly low maintenance. They don't call us a lot. We don't have a ton of interaction with them as far as needy things. We have a couple of members that are fairly high touch and need some attention. One older woman who is having a lot of problems with some things that we have to help her with, and one younger person that we've helped her with some financial things and some other things when she had some job problems during COVID, and try to just stay in touch with our members the best we can. There's a few members in our shepherding group that we don't really get much interaction with at all, and I think they like it that way, and that's okay. Not everybody in the church that's in your shepherding group is going to be your best friend, and you have to kind of be okay with that. So there can be some months where there's really no real interaction besides checking in with somebody, with the people in our shepherding group. And there's some months where I get, you know, multiple calls from somebody that wants me to try to help them with something. And that doesn't mean that you're the person that has to do the task. It just means that they're you're their connection, right? So you're trying to hook them up with somebody who can help them. And if there is a really high need, especially as a deacon, I'll segue here to Jeremy, who used to run our Mercy Committee, and now Joe Melito runs it. We actually, as the deacon, we have a subset of the diaconate called the Mercy Committee, and those guys are a little more dedicated to helping with mercy cases that might be prolonged or take, you know, continued interaction, so that you don't just get swamped with something that's maybe out of your bandwidth or out of your capacity. So we have plenty of resources to help out with stuff like that.
Yeah, so I've been on the diaconate, as I said, four years. I've been on the Mercy Committee all 4 years. The middle 2 years, I led the Mercy, or I chaired the Mercy Committee, and this year I transitioned it to Joe Melito. I guess backing up, sort of, what does a week look like for me? I support two elders, Jim Sutton and Larry Crouch, and I try to connect with both of those guys at least every 2 to 3 weeks on the phone, just to, we have a standing call early in the morning. Larry, I call on Tuesdays, and Jim, I call on Thursday morning. A lot of weeks, there's nothing going on. It's just, hey, how's it going? How's your family? How are you doing? Have you heard anything about the group? But that's been really good because I've gotten to know those guys really well. So I would encourage you, if you're a deacon, make a regular plan to contact your elder. If you're an elder, make a regular plan to contact your deacon, because it's really easy for a lot of weeks to go by, and then you only see them at the session meetings, and you know, you don't develop a strong relationship. So that's been a blessing, just getting to know those guys and share prayer requests, even if they're small ones, personal prayer requests. That's been great, and also hear about what's going on with the group. Jim and Larry's groups and our groups are also fairly low maintenance. We don't have a lot of needs within the groups, but when they do come up, you know, the important thing about being a deacon is knowing where to find resources and help people, knowing how to get money if that's needed, or contractors, that's a big thing. People need things fixed, and you either need to know who to reach out to, or if you know a contractor, working with the other deacons, those sorts of things. Car repairs is a big one, knowing reputable car dealership, and the other deacons will help you do these things, but that tends to be what a lot of the issues are, medical bills. From a Mercy Committee standpoint, that's been it's been great to be on the Mercy Committee, both because it's been incredible to see how generous Christ Covenant is in terms of mercy giving and the budget and the amount of money that people give towards mercy. That's been amazing. And then working on mercy cases has been very fulfilling and gratifying. Also, it can be a little, be challenging, because there are people that will try to take advantage, especially those outside the church. We do have some rules and regulations, parameters put in place for how much we can give to non-members. Sometimes we help them, sometimes we don't. I've had some really interesting experiences talking to people that were clearly trying to, for lack of a better word, scam money out of us, and saying no to those types of people, being discerning about it, and working with the other deacons, learning how to do that, and what we can, as deacons, what we can give money to, the limits. These are all things, there is a handbook for that, so as a deacon, you want to at least read through that, become somewhat familiar, but the deacons on the Mercy Committee can help you get more familiar with that. Otherwise, you know, counting, communion prep, both of those things have gotten a lot easier since COVID.
We do those twice a year, right?
Twice a year, yep. And then the session meetings are the other things that are sort of regular. But you can go a couple of months without doing a whole lot if you're you know, the community that, or the group that you're in is quiet, and then you have a couple months where there's a lot of activity. So it can be, from a deacon perspective, it can be very quiet for a while and then a lot of activity in a short amount of time.
A couple things I'll add about the kind of the typical week, or a month, excuse me, for an elder. There are typically one session meeting a month, a couple months during the year we skip, but it's going to be a session meeting. A couple other things that come periodically, and I'll highlight these because they're really probably my favorite things to do as an elder, just because of what they do for me and the chance to serve other people. You know, we serve communion typically once a month, and that has been a profound experience for me, to an approach to communion, and just personally what we're doing. But to serve communion is a joy. It's obviously during the worship service, so it's not an extra meeting, but that is a delight. My two other probably favorite things are interviewing, going through communicants through the process, and then interviewing them to become a member. And that's done, it's about every, maybe twice a year, but it depends on your elder shepherding group and who in your elder shepherding group has a student or child of age. But I'm doing two right now, it's fun to interact with a fifth or sixth grader on their level about the gospel, and to see them with their parents kind of in the background having the conversation. And that's, I think each one I meet with about three times in person, usually on a Sunday afternoon I'll go meet with them. And that's a delight. I also really enjoy new member interviews, which I think we do about three times a year. I think I've interviewed one of you to join the church, Chuck, I think. Worked out okay?
Yeah, so far so good.
Okay, well, from our perspective too. It's just fun to hear testimonies, you know, even boring ones that are just, I never remember a day I don't know the Lord. It's like, well, praise the Lord, it's still a miracle of the gospel. So I enjoy that. I think one thing to add, Matt kind of emphasized the study and just personal devotions and piety that are important. My family's in my elder shepherding group. I'm kind of an organized kind of rule follower, and I've got a day of the week devoted. Every person in my elder shepherding group, I have a certain day of the week I pray for them, whether they've given me a request or not. I just make them up based on what I know about them, to be praying for them. I try to very organically run into the folks in my elder shepherding group, see them at Sunday school, see them at Sunday night church, speak to them, see how they're doing. Not a lot of them are making that easy, though, very few reach out. I don't know, different times maybe you guys have different experiences, but I would love for them to reach out to me and say, hey, here's some things you can pray for me for. Here's some things we're struggling with, or here's some things just to praise God for. But trying to be intentional about having a relationship with them, to encourage them, to be praying for them in a meaningful way. One last thing I'll add, I've served on the shepherding committee, and we have an additional meeting once a month, again, about 10 months of the year. So that's one meeting a month, and there's some interaction in between meetings. As a committee, there's prayer involved, obviously. And that's where there's, I think, five people on the shepherding committee right now, five elders, which represent and operate as a commission of the entire session. But that's been very impactful, because you really see and you're reminded that we're all sheep, that we're all weak, we all have struggles, and we're seeing things in a shepherding and or discipline environment where you see really challenged and struggling situations. You think you can picture some complicated scenarios, and we see very complicated scenarios. But it's a need for prayer, it's a need for the gospel to change hearts and to mend and restore things that are broken. And that's also been very impactful in a positive way. Really, and Derek and some staff bear the brunt of that on a regular basis, but at a certain point, the shepherding committee gets involved, and we just got to pray. It's Jesus' church. It's his church, so we just need to pray for that. But that's one meeting a month, about an hour and a half. And there's a couple other committees. I'm sure you guys have kind of talked through the structure of that, but that's probably the main reason why I'm looking forward to my sabbatical. So, and the sabbatical means I won't go to eight session meetings a year. I won't go to the shepherding committee. I'll still be involved with the shepherding of my elder shepherding group. So it's not like it's that big of a break. It's just I don't have to go to the session meeting. So, but still get to be engaged and involved in the life of body life, and in particular my elder shepherding group.
Matt or Will, can you just say something more about the communicants process? Because, you know, it's one thing to shepherd adults. Maybe more intimidating to think about, okay, I'm going to shepherd some young children, fifth grade children. So just briefly, what's that process look like? What do you have to do when you're doing this communicant stuff?
You go first.
Well, as you'd expect, we go through the Book of Church Order, Westminster Confession. No, I'm just kidding. We don't do that at all. It is interesting because these are, each one I've experienced, you've got kids that probably know the right answer. Right? Jesus is, the answer is Jesus. And what you're trying to discern is, do they have a valid, legitimate profession of faith? Are they trusting in Christ? And they can't articulate it like our seminary graduates. And so you try to, you know, a parent is going to be in the room or nearby, maybe not right at the table, but nearby as you're doing it. And you really want to hear from the child. You want to hear their voice. You want to hear their heart. And you start out at the beginning, and some of them are probably ready to profess faith right then. But talking to them on their level about the workbook, the parents are primarily responsible for working through a workbook with them. They do that on a weekly basis if they stay current. But I parachute in about three different times, ask them about the workbook, ask them about questions they have, ask them about, you know, just different things about what's fifth grade like and what are your friends like, and just try to get to know them. But it culminates with basically asking them about their testimony. Do they trust in Christ? Going over membership vows. You kind of have to translate the membership vows to a fifth grade level. But it's neat to see them express that. You know, you don't have to join the church right now. You don't have to. You know, do you own your own faith? Is this something that you want to profess in front of people publicly, and you want to walk with Christ? And so it's neat to see them and to watch their parent in the background going, yeah, all right. So it's fun because you're going to talk to a fifth grader. And it's neat to see them express things in their own words in a meaningful way. And so, again, it's one of the favorite things I do.
Yeah, so my first, I've just now had my first set of communicants this time around. So God was gracious to let me kind of find my legs before I had to jump right in and do communicants too, because I find that actually harder than talking to new members, etc. It's just skill sets, passions, whatever. So that was a little more of a challenge to me, partly because the members that I had were, and Will mentioned, or somebody, or a couple of guys mentioned it, sometimes the reciprocation on the relationship is not as fluid as you'd like, right? So some the members that I interviewed, or the communicants that I've been dealing with, are part of families that I've had a harder time connecting with. And so here's the thing that I struggled with coming into the session was, am I able to do it? And then second, when I meet prophetic resistance, if I'm calling out and I'm not getting any response, what's my reaction going to be? Am I just going to stop, shrink? And so I've had to repent. A lot of times I won't. It's like, well, they don't want to talk to me, so I'll just, I'll see them the next time. And so, man, you gotta be just diligent in pursuing. And it's true for communicants. It's true for the parents. It has been. It's interesting. You have to think through. Well, how am I going to ask this question to a 12-year-old? And then how do you interpret the response, right? And I went to Paul Joyce and I said, Paul, how do you do a communicant interview? You know, how do you get in there? So having someone you can lean on, an older, elder, older deacon, whatever, to say, hey, help me along the way. You know, when Jesus sent out the apostles in the 72, he sent them out in pairs. And there's a lot of great reasons for that. And one of them is, hey, how do I do this? Help me out here, kind of thing. And so that was it. So it was actually kind of a learning experience for me right now. And so I feel better about what I've learned. But sometimes I fall off the bike and I go, now I've learned some stuff. Now I need to follow up better. Now I need to initiate better. So there is, anyway, so that was my experience this first time around.
Yeah. Yeah. So. And there are there opportunities like for both for elders and deacons for this kind of mentoring thing where if you found that, other elders or other deacons are willing to, as you're coming in, willing to kind of take you by the hand and show you the ropes, give you experiences, things like that?
Yeah, I nominated someone. I nominated Paul Joyce to be my mentor. He doesn't know it, but I still, I see him every week, and I got his cell phone number, so I just, if he picks up, I ask him a question, and so he's very gracious, and we talk through a lot of stuff, but I just kind of felt like I needed it. So I'll ask some other folks. I talked to Larry Crouch, actually, because I know he used to do a lot of communicant stuff. So I said, hey, what do you think about this? Brent did Mercy Ministry for a while. Hey, Brent, what do you think about this? And just trying to get ideas and insight. Because you're having to learn a lot on the fly.
I mean, one thing I'd add, related to that elder helping elder, or deacon helping deacon, our elder shepherding groups are kind of man-made, contrived. I've got some people in the church that I've known for 20 years that if they went through a crisis, they might reach out to me before they reach out to their elder that's assigned to them. And I do not say, actually, Matt Linder's your elder. I appreciate you sharing that. Why don't you call Matt? Let me transfer you to Matt. there is, I think, a great sense of cooperation with, hey, here's someone that's expressed a need. They're my friend. I want to reach out. I want to help. I want to listen. And to the extent, you know, I might encourage them, hey, this is great. You know, why don't we sit down and make sure you get your elder up to speed, or I'll stay involved. I'm not trying to get rid of them, but there is a sense of, we're kind of, in one sense, playing the zone defense, where if there are needs in the church and they're reaching out to me because they have a relationship with me and my wife, well, you love them. You take care of them and you love them. And to what extent you incorporate other people or your pastor involved, I think makes sense to do that. So, yeah, the elder deacon dinners, which usually start at like 6 o'clock before a session meeting, can be helpful just to introduce yourself and meet some of the men. And you think, well, don't you know them all? Not really. Some of them I know by name, but to sit there and just introduce yourself, learn a little bit about them, and then eventually you're going to find a situation where reaching out to them specifically because of who's in their elder shepherding group or because of the experience they have, Larry Crouch and his experience with Mercy, or people that have led a lot of kids through the communicants class can be a great resource. So, there's a great spirit of cooperation, I think, because we all know the objective is to love and care for Christ's church. And I can't do that alone. Matt can't do that alone. And, even as we segment it just to help give good coverage, it's still
the image that I have is they're the Lord's sheep, they're the Lord's people, and we are all 50 under shepherds, and all of the deacons support that. And you know, you're right, I see people all the time that I would talk with because we're in the orbit together, or I see them for whatever. So there's that spirit of cooperation, that co-labor.
Jason, Jeremy, you guys mentioned that you have a responsibility to do some counting. Maybe you could just share exactly what that means, and then communion. But then also share something a little bit more about the mercy process. So, okay, I'm a new deacon, and somebody calls me and says, my hot water heater just blew up. You know what? How does the process go, or what would I do as a deacon, or how would I be involved, or something like that?
I'll do the counting communion, let you talk about the mercy.
Sounds good.
So we got some teams that we've put together. It's five or six guys on a team, depending on how it shakes out. And we've got a rotation set up. It's really easy. We just, after the church service is over in the morning, we the ushers or the worship coordinators have already collected the bulk of the offering and put it in the safe. We pull the money from the boxes, put it in the safe, go to the house, come back in the evening service. After the evening service, we pull the remaining money and we go count the money. All of the checks get marked a certain way and stamped and put in one bag, and we count the cash. We have to separate out the special offering. If it's a communion Sunday, we are taking up a different offering for a different ministry each month, and we're separating that aside for that ministry, and then the other cash that's earmarked for just general fund, we would account for it as well. We put it down on a deposit sheet, seal it all up. The idea is such that the only people that touch the cash are deacons. And there's never a situation where there's one deacon alone with the cash. There's always multiple deacons together. So we've got it set up so you've easily got multiple people around you just for accountability and protection of your own integrity there. So the church staff actually never touches the cashier. The deacons count it, they seal it up, they fill out the deposit slip, And the only thing that the staff, like Sandy's crew, they take care of the checks, and they write down the total balance for the checks that are going to our general fund and which ones are going that are maybe earmarked for other types of giving. And they account for all of that, and then they take the whole thing to the bank on Monday and rinse and repeat. So when you're on when you're on team for counting, you would do that for that month. Like I'm on the counting rotation right now, so every Sunday in April I do the counting, and then when May comes, somebody else takes it over and their team does it. They end up doing it twice a year. The following month after you finish your counting, we're on duty for communion setup. So you show up, it's about 7:38 in the morning. Now I think we just come at 8 now because it's a lot easier with the prepackaged communions. And we get out all the communion ware. We have to do some certain things to prepare, like the table up front and the cloths and some few things. And we set up all the communion. And when there's ever the elders get done serving it, at the end of the service, we'll clean it up. And they're we do like the Monday, Thursday, and sometimes they'll do one at Christmas time. I don't remember if we did a Christmas Eve communion. It's been a few years. We used to do that.
Aren't you guys on standby in case there's an elder shortage?
Yes.
Right? It's true, too.
If we're doing a communion setup, the idea is that you would come and usually if there's a shortage, it's probably like a couple of guys in the balcony that are short. So we always try to check in. They're in the prayer room before and say, hey, how are you looking? If they say, oh, we really need somebody, we'll send a guy or two upstairs to help serve it in the balcony. They would prefer to have deacons serve communion over worship coordinators. We've had worship coordinators serve it in the past as a really in a pinch, but generally they would rather have a deacon serve it. And they've also sometimes pulled some elders out of the seats to serve it as well. But those two duties are very easy. There's not a lot of thinking that has to happen. You kind of show up and do it and go home. It's a good time of fellowship because you're on the same team. You have a captain, and you get to hang out with the guys and, you know, get to know people a little bit better. Sometimes we do prayer requests and, you know, get to know people a little bit better. But those are not things to stress about, and they're not major time consumers. I mean, you're staying, you know, your belly's going to be rumbling a little bit on the Sunday that you're counting because you got to stay a little bit later. What does it take to count? Like 45 minutes?
Yeah, 30 to 45.
Yeah, so you're staying a little bit late, and after the night service, you're staying a little bit later to finish up everything. And then the communion Sunday, you're showing up a little bit early. But it's not like you're making a bunch of extra trips and having to really do a whole lot of extra work to do those things. And it's really a joy to serve the church and do that. So don't stress out about those two tasks. If you're concerned about taking the office of being a deacon, those are not things to really worry about. They're easygoing.
Yeah, and the senior deacons will guide you through it. So the first year that you're a deacon, just realize you're going to show up and you're going to be given, like, count the cash and we'll take care of the rest, and you'll learn the process. So it's pretty easy. You have a year or two to really figure out before you would get assigned as a team lead and have to take responsibility. In terms of mercy, you know, I think the process would be somebody will bring to your attention, oftentimes your elder, but sometimes not, that somebody's got some sort of issue where they need financial assistance. And it could be, like I said, a lot of it is appliances, cars, medical bills. Sometimes it's more of a crisis like unemployment where there's really cash flow issues that are sort of open-ended and unknown. Those can be really challenging. But it's the one time, you know, we need $5,000 for car repairs and we don't, you know, we only got $1,000 in our savings account. That's pretty common. One thing I will say is sometimes you have to dig for those. So you have to press on your people and get your elder to press, because people that oftentimes, I mean, I think I can relate to this, when you get to a bad financial situation, you don't want to be open about it. You want to hide it and you want to hope that it goes away. So sometimes we run into these situations where if they'd let us know 3 months ago, it would have been a lot easier to deal with, and now we've got a mess on our hands. Sometimes you hear about it, like a common one is, you know, for those of you who know Keith Hudson, he runs an HVAC company. Sometimes they come in roundabout through him. Hey, so-and-so's AC died. You know, we've just had a couple of these, and he's an officer, so he'll let the deacons know, and then we'll get somebody involved and make a phone call. So there's a number of ways that they can come in. And then really there's dollar limits, so up to, I think it's $300. I should know this because I wrote the most recent version of the Mercy Manual, so I should know these amounts. But up to $300, I think it's $300, one deacon can approve. So if you've got to give somebody $200 or spend $200 to do something, you could just make it happen. You don't need another deacon. Up to $500, I think you need two. Yeah, so up to $200 is one deacon. Up to $500 is two deacons. Up to $1,000, three deacons. And then above $1,000, you've got to get the entire Mercy Committee involved, and there has to be a majority vote that takes place.
We don't give people money. We pay their bills directly.
That's right.
For them.
Yeah, we never put money into people's checking accounts. We pay the bills. So that is one. That's one thing. And there are some, like, we don't make credit card payments. We don't pay student loans. There's a bunch of things that we won't do. But what the deacons will do in the really sort of more severe cases is get involved, help people budget things. Sometimes we'll enlist the help of somebody like Will, who knows how to help people budget and plan, and you know, help them come up with a financial plan where they can live within their means. Because a lot of times people need money because they're not living within their means, and it's a deeper issue than just an immediate need. So, and then you have the interesting ones where somebody sends a letter or an email to the church and says, "I need money," and it's kind of like, "What's going on here?" You go meet with them and you find out they're just trying to get money out of the church. That doesn't happen too much, but it does happen, and you really got to be discerning because people can tell really good stories, and that's what the policies and procedures are for, to protect the church. And you can just say, "Look, this is our policies and procedures. Sorry, we can't give you money because of this." So,
When would you get the Mercy Committee involved versus you handle it yourself? What would be a general guideline for that?
Well, if the dollar amount's over $1,000, so that's an obvious one. And if it's if it may go above $1,000, so that's another one. If say somebody needs $500 for something, but they also are kind of living right on the edge of their means, and we think, okay, they need $500 now, but we know their car's in bad shape, we know that's they've got a bunch of medical bills coming in 3 months or 6 months, we'll have a call with the Mercy Committee. And the Mercy Committee meets, we're required to meet once a quarter. Sometimes we meet more frequently than that. A lot of times it's on Zoom. Sometimes we do them in person, but most of the time it's on Zoom. And
or like a recurring thing, we would want the Mercy Committee.
Yeah, if there's a recurring. We do have, there is a dollar amount, I think, for members. The maximum dollar amount in a year is $12,000 that we can give to members. For non-members, I think it's $2,000 a year. And non-members are required to have a connection to the church, a member who can say that, yes, this is a legitimate need, or a lot of times it's an affiliation with one of our ministries, like Trail Life or some other ministry of the church where they've got some connection, they're known, they're not just coming in from the outside asking for money.
So Christ Covenant has, every year, they put $40,000 into the budget for Mercy. And on top of that, we get gifts from members that are earmarked for Mercy specifically. That somebody will write a check and they'll say, "This is for Mercy," to members. And on top of that, we take two offerings per year. Like, remember, we know when we do the monthly offerings for different agencies or organizations, well, two of those will generally be for the Mercy to Members Fund, or sometimes they call it the Deacons Fund. All of those things go into a bucket of money that we are able to distribute to those in need. So we are very blessed with a lot of resources to help people. And we encourage the deacons to give that money away. We encourage the deacons to be good stewards of that money and to ask questions to make sure that we're giving it to somebody who really needs it and that it's an appropriate use of that money. But we encourage them to give the money away and not to, you know, try to set too many, like, you can really get really legalistic when you're trying to serve somebody sometimes, and you can almost always find a reason not to give somebody the money. If you ask enough questions and have enough guys involved in it, somebody will figure out why you shouldn't give them the money. Well, my philosophy is that we should try to give people the money and help them and serve the church that way, and not try to find a bunch of ways not to, you know, not to give that money away, because that's what it's intended for. We do have Walmart gift cards that are in $25 increments, and you can go get a stack of those as a deacon without any questions asked. And I do tell the deacons, if you really need to give somebody a blessing and you don't want to ask a lot of questions, throw them some Walmart gift cards and just help them out that way. You can give them 4 gift cards and they can go get some groceries with it or whatever, and you don't have to ask a lot of questions with that. You can just bless somebody. And sometimes you just bless somebody and you pray to God that he's going to use that, and you don't need to know what happens with the rest of it.
I will say, we've never, in the 4 years that I've been on the Mercy Committee, we've never actually had to use any of the money that was in the budget. We've always been able to take money out of the Mercy Fund, which is the money that's given from members and earmarked for Mercy.
Great. Okay, let's let you guys ask questions for a while here. John?
A couple of questions for Matt and Will. How many families or members are in your shepherding groups? Like, how many are you responsible for?
So it starts with your immediate family. Your family will be moved into your shepherding group. And I know that sounds obvious, but it's actually a good reminder, because I got one guy, now I got 10, now I got 12. It's got to start with the home, right? So you have a shepherding group right now, right? So it's the immediate family. I think I have currently 31 total souls.
So 31 households?
No, 31 people,
souls.
Maybe souls,
souls.
You know, yeah,
souls.
10 families or something, because okay. it changed. I don't know the exact number.
Okay.
I think I've got 12 family units. Some are singles, and some are married with 3 kids. So, again, it does kind of change the dynamic of how you would reach out to them or how many people you're really addressing. And married couple, 2 kids out of college, living somewhere else, and maybe 2 kids in the home that would be part of the elder shepherding group. The 2 that live in Chattanooga or Knoxville, they're technically not in our elder shepherding group, but to minister to that family, you still kind of stay in touch with the parents about prayer requests for the adult children living somewhere else. So it does vary. I've had several people in the 4 years get married and move away. Several people leave the church, and then periodically I've got 2 family units moving into my elder shepherding group here in another month or so, because they just joined the church. So it is dynamic.
Okay.
But right,
so
now I think it's 12.
I started with just 1 in addition to my family. So that was...
For Matt,
so,
we wanted to start slow.
Sure.
Kind of ramp up.
They did. I had training wheels and a bubble and everything else.
Swimmies,
yeah. But it is nice, because first of all, you're ordained in June. The first class, most likely the first class of people coming in, they don't officially join the church till December. So you'll get a couple coming in, first of all, just maybe people that have moved in, somehow they're a member of the church that hadn't been assigned or something. So I had 1 person, just college student at UNCC. That was helpful, because then I could just figure things out. I had a little bit of... And then the first members class that went through, 100 people joined. So I figured, well, that's where my people are coming from, so I'm going to go meet them in the members class. I recommend that for all new elders, to go over there and be a table host at the new members class. Because that's where you're going to get 10 touches with them that would take you maybe 2 years to get otherwise. And you're going to get it in 10 weeks. So get in there, start meeting with... Now, you might not know who's going to be in your shepherding group, but you'll meet some folks. That is a great way. So then I was like, hey, Derek, I'd like to... Actually, I'd email Stacy and say, so I met these folks, I talked to them, and I've developed a relationship with them already. Is it possible that you can get them assigned, you know, to me? And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
Okay.
A lot of moving parts. But so it ramps up, and then I think you'll get capped out at around 30 people, probably 10 families, somewhere in that range.
Okay. And for Jason, Jeremy, you guys said that, I think, Jason, you said that you have two elders that you work with?
I have one. He has two.
I have two.
You have two. So does that mean you have 60 souls that you're kind of, is that how that works? Like,
yeah, but
you try to make touches with?
But as far as the deacon's role there is, I typically only get involved if there is an issue.
Okay.
So the elder's taking, you know, the lead on the regular communication.
Okay. So he'll contact you, hey, there's an issue here,
yeah.
And can you come in?
Yes.
Okay. So that's how it works.
Yeah. When we first set this up, the original idea was that we were going to have like a one-to-one of everything, but we have a good bit more elders and deacons and enough members that I've kind of realigned the deacons a little bit to where I feel like their best chance of being successful is to really focus on the elder and make sure the elder's taken care of and let the elder reach out to the members. And then and there's a lot of cases where the deacon needs to be interacting directly with members, and that's not like something that we don't encourage. It's just that I don't think that it's reasonable to have every deacon try to talk to every single member, and then the elders also do that independently. It's got to be more of a team type environment.
I think, John, that the idea is the elder's going to be more of an initiator, reaching out on a regular basis, touching base, phone calls or emails on a regular basis. I think the deacon's role primarily is one that would be more reactionary. Either the elder calls them in or a church member might come to them, but they're going to be more responsive rather than an initiator with that. Sometimes that's not the case, but I think that's the primary way.
Don't underestimate the power of a spouse, because the elders and deacons' wives are very highly involved in this as well. And that's something you all should consider. If you're married, this needs to be a team decision for you to become an officer. Your wife needs to be on board and ready to be that. That doesn't mean your wife is going to be an elder or that she's got to have all these responsibilities, but I have seen a lot of very successful couples where the wife is extremely helpful in the ministry because they're a lot better at stuff than we are, quite frankly. And
usually when I call Jim Sutton, I say, "What's going on, Jim?" And I hear him say, "What's going on?" He's talking to Donna.
Donna, what's going on?
She's got to remind him. So
the reality is a lot of times if there's an issue that a woman member of the church wants to bring up, she may feel more comfortable approaching or talking to a female, which could be a shepherdess, it could be a prayer coordinator, or it could be an elder or deacon's wife if they have a relationship with them. So it does sometimes, you become aware of things through your spouse. I don't have a lot of cases where I would say that's true, but I know it happens across the board because, again, they're going to tend to be more spiritual. They're going to tend to want to bring stuff to people's attention quicker than their husband probably would, and they may feel more comfortable approaching a woman in leadership or that works at the church, and that's how we can learn about it.
Okay.
So the interesting part on that, just to add one other thing, is I also try to make – I address the man first because I can sit, and I actually have a discussion with most of them and say, look, we're talking shepherd to shepherd, right? You're ultimately responsible for your flock. I'm going to talk to you. How are you doing? How are you nourishing yourself so that you can nourish the others, right? And so I start there and try to build a relationship with him first. And then, you know, and there might be dysfunction there that might percolate up through the spouse or other avenues. But it is a fair point. So you're not signing your wife up necessarily to do the hours and the task you're doing. However, she does need to be on board with what's required of you, right? And I wanted to make sure she was okay because the part I was worried about was, well, how come you're shepherding them and you didn't shepherd our family this way? And have any resentment or any division that Satan could grab a wedge and say, well, why are you doing this here? You have to be doing it at home first. That's why I started with my own family. It's like that is a perfect opportunity for Satan to get in and just burrow in and
yeah.
cause division. So you need to be aligned, although my wife is serving in other areas. She's on the mission field in medicine, right? So she's talking to people all day. She's on the school board. She's like, I can't do a lot of the things that some of the other spouses can do, at least not right now. So,
Chuck.
I got one thing. What I think are three quick hits. Does the church have a communication software resource that you guys can use to keep track of and log calls, those sorts of things? Does that make sense of blank books?
There is a software program that's database driven that's mostly one way download. I'm getting information on, if I want to look you up later, send you an email, I could go find it.
Got it.
Okay. I keep, because I'm an engineer, I forgot to mention that earlier, and I'm sure Will has one too, I'm going to guess, a spreadsheet of my people, right? And the reason I do that, because I watch my wife do charts and she's writing notes about it, and I thought, why do you do that? She's like, so I can remember next time I see them. So I keep a chart on all of my families so that I can remember what we talked about last time and to follow up. And so there isn't, I wish there was, that I could log that, and then if someone else bumped into them, they could say.
At some point, I'd be interested in looking over your shoulder to see.
Well, it's like medical records in some way, right?
Because you designed your own thing.
Well, correct. Yeah, designed, yeah. Well, it's a spreadsheet with tabs.
Correct. It's not, we can't enter
Bill Gates that designed
database,
it.
But we can do it.
The second thing was for Jason and Jeremy. I presume that you have some pretty good guardrails for when something will go clearly off the rails, or it's a more serious emotional, psychological issue. Could you speak to that, what that looks like?
Yeah, I mean, if it's like a counseling or really a spiritual need, the deacons will really want to get the elder and the pastor involved in that community, and approach that from a team perspective.
The church has some fairly well-defined guidelines on that.
I think it's built into the role, so the deacons are, we deal with material needs. And when something is obviously spiritual, it's a shepherding issue, it's a sin issue, you have to get your elder involved. And then typically the elder will say, well, we need to get the pastor. I mean, I've had cases where financial trouble is clearly, there's a spiritual or heart sin issue.
It's going to get to the elder involved, then probably the pastor, and then probably Derek Wells, who does more of the counseling. And things stay fairly compartmentalized with that. If there's a situation in Matt's elder shepherding group, it might get escalated to his pastor and to Derek. I won't hear anything about that. Even on the shepherding committee, I don't hear about it for a long time. So that's obviously for privacy. But
it stays compartmentalized from our spouses.
Yes.
And so I tell people when I meet with them, we're talking in confidence, confidentiality. Consider it like that. Unless you ask me to share it with someone, I'm not going to. And so I think it's important they know that, and it's important our spouses know that, and because certain things, it's just better off, and I'm sure Tom has already mentioned it. I learned it from him.
But. The third and final one, I think this is more for Will, because you went through the kind of regenerating of that whole, there was a major committee that was formed for this church 3 or 4 years ago, and they looked at trellis and vine for the shepherding model.
Right.
And now we've got a shepherd leader. How do you square those two, or do you need to?
I wasn't on that committee that did that, but
the one at Nino.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, that was kind of the impetus to create these elder shepherding groups, so that we would have a structure where every member is assigned to someone. There's some accountability. In one sense, when you think of shepherding the flock, and we got 1,700 people, that's overwhelming. Oh, but now you've given me 10 households. Okay, that's more manageable. In
the
terms
philosophies
of
philosophies between those two books, that's interesting to me. How?
Yeah, I don't know that I can speak to the intricacies of that, not having reviewed either book recently. One of the things I want to point out a moment ago, because relative to the previous question. Because I know when I was sitting in your shoes and thinking about becoming an elder, the one predominant thought I had going through the class was, I can't do this. When you read about shepherding the flock and the spiritual care and oversight, and the significance of that was, I'm not capable. I'm not equipped. I'm not sufficient.
That's the place you need to be.
Yeah. Yes. But then it's realize, okay, it's the power of the Holy Spirit, it's working with other people. And the one thing I'm going to be very quick to do is say, this is out of my depth. So one of these things comes up that starts financial but becomes spiritual and some other things. Hey, Pastor Derek, Dave Baxter, get in here. Hey, Derek Wells, get in. Let's get Tom. Who do I help? So I don't fear a lot of people are living in some and working in some relationships where they're out of their depth for long because I think they feel very inadequate for that. So that's the benefit of that is it's going to be quick to call in reinforcements, to get some counsel, to get some advice. How do we escalate this too? I mean, they may need a professional counselor. They may need multiple eyes on it. They may need someone that doesn't have a full-time job that does this as a volunteer. Hey, this is a pastor who's got more training and expertise. So I think that's one thing that should be reassuring to you is, okay, they're not going to ask me to do things I can't do. And I am limited. But also God has called elders and deacons to serve in these capacities. So in terms of the trellis vine superstructure, I don't know that I can help get any more specific with that. But I do think there's a good understanding because I was here right as we changed to the new shepherding model. And compared to what we were doing before, it's fantastic in terms of coverage. But
the prior church used the trellis vine, but it shook out a different way.
Okay.
The group leaders were part of the triage team, and it was just a different model.
Okay.
So, fellas, I have my pastoral community. I have 8 elders that are in that community, each having 10 households or whatever. And then I have 4 deacons that are also part of that community. So we have a team of like 13. Now that's not even thinking about the women are part of that community that provide some leadership as prayer coordinators, service coordinators, the shepherdesses. So we're really functioning at, as a team model at this church, which is good. So you're not on your own. There's folks that you're working with that care for people.
Is the ratio of deacons to elders fairly consistent throughout? 4, you said?
Yeah, I have 4. Yeah, I would think it's fairly consistent.
48 elders and how many?
I think we have like almost 1.5 times as many elders as deacons, something like that.
Yeah, so it might be part of your community too, then what we assess are the needs.
I'll tell you though, before we did this, because I was on the committee that helped set up the initial shepherding groups, really all the members were each going directly to the pastors for shepherding. And the elders were not, unless they had some relationship with a member, they weren't the first look. So every member in this church, what did we say we got, 1,700? They're all going to our pastors. How many we got now? 2,200, okay, I'm way off. Each of these members is trying to go directly to a pastor for shepherding, and that was just completely unsustainable. So we had to spread this thing out some more, or there was just no way that people were going to get the attention that they needed from the shepherding standpoint.
Feature and then John. 2 things. One, I'd be interested in hearing from Will and Matt about any experiences you've had in conflict resolution between or among members. That would be one. Another one would be part of our membership vows are if we ever decide, if I decide I want to leave the church body, I'm supposed to communicate that to an elder. I know in reality, a lot of people don't do that. But have you had any experiences with people saying, I'm leaving, or we're leaving, and what have those conversations been like?
Not from dysfunction. So I've been doing it 2 years, and I've had people move away to take jobs.
Yeah.
Not leave through disagreement, not leave out of disgruntlement, or leave for disappointment or anything. So nothing there. But I will say when people leave the church, I get an email from Jenny saying, "Hey, so and so has contacted the church to transfer their letter. Are you aware of this?" And it's nice to be able to say, "Yes, we've been talking." So staying in touch with people and knowing what their situation is very helpful. For conflict resolution, when I was in your shoes, I was thinking I'm going to be dealing with marital disputes, I'm going to be dealing with end-of-life issues all the time, a lot of counseling things that I thought, man, I'm an engineer, I have no idea. Mostly I'm dealing with people who go through what we all go through. They're not in the Word enough, they're not praying enough, they got a short temper, they're too busy. It's all of the things we're all dealing with. And that's most of my counseling is saying, hey man, get back in the Word so that you are not having conflict. Yeah. Now, Will's on the shepherding committee, so he's basically in the oncology department in some ways, right? I mean, he's getting a lot of the pathology, I think, because he's on a committee that deals with pathology, right? So he's saying a lot more than I.
I have not seen a lot of conflict resolution. I've seen a lot of conflict.
Okay, right.
In terms of the communication about things that is somewhat of a disappointment for me is when I started, we took the existing members and said, boom, here's your elder. And so a lot of these people have been at the church for a while, and a lot of them just don't initiate stuff with me. And I probably should take it personally. But they haven't been trained. They haven't realized this is the way to do it. And I would love for them to reach out and say, you know what? You know, just respond to one of my emails. Hey, I'm doing fine. Got no updates for you, but we're doing fine. I mean, that would be fabulous. Because otherwise I send these emails or make phone calls and they just don't respond. And I don't see them at Sunday school, and I see them at church in the distance up in the balcony, but they leave really fast. So it's been difficult with many of them to do that. Now, newer members have gone through the new members class and kind of been trained and coached a little bit that this is our superstructure and this is the organization we have and this is why it's valuable. So I'm pursuing people a lot and not getting the responsiveness I would prefer. Conflict resolution. There's a lot of stuff that's come to the shepherding committee that's come through Derek as a counselor that he's been dealing with. He said, I've been dealing with this for a year and a half. Now I'm going to make you guys aware of this. It's kind of like, whew, wow, you've been in this situation for a year and a half. Most of the stuff out there is probably apathy and indifference by the husband that creates. And that's, we can probably all relate to that in some areas of our own life where, yeah, I didn't take the lead and initiate quite the way I should. But, you know, that goes on for 5 or 10 years, and you get some dissatisfaction, and you get some angst. And so some of that is prodding and coaching and trying to disciple, but you can only work with them to the extent they're responsive. So I've had people leave the church without letting me know, and then I finally track it. Oh, yeah, I'm in Knoxville now. Oh, okay. Well, good luck. I'll pray for you. But that communication hasn't been fantastic. But there are issues. I mean, if you sat down with every family long enough, you could find some issues of conflict and tension, just like you could with me and my wife, probably, if you wanted to unearth it. But most of it is, I'll say, normalish. There are cases, though, that get very delicate and very complex that end up coming through the shepherding committee. And when they come to the shepherding committee, we find out, well, Derek's known about it. The elder probably in that community has known about it, but we're just learning about it for the first time. So there are cases where it gets more difficult. But again, I'm not a professional counselor. I can pray for him, but it's pretty quickly to say, hey, Derek, could maybe even get an outside counselor involved is the way to handle it. So Derek's not looking at me as the elder saying, well, you should be able to solve this. You should be able to dive in there, meet with him every other week, and you'll fix it. I mean, no one's expecting that from me, which is a great relief.
John, so for the two deacons, you're working as a team member for the elders and the shepherding, correct? Mm-hmm. So how often do you get called in on a situation? What might be an example where you would be called in?
Lady in my group had credit card fraud, needed some help with it. I get calls for people to need something done with their house and they need to find an honest contractor. They don't know how to make the repairs themselves. Somebody who can't make their rent because they got laid off of their work because of COVID and they need the church to help them pay their bills. I don't know. But a lady's trying to set up some power of attorney because she's going into a nursing home type community and doesn't have family in town, needs some help with some stuff like that. It's usually physical, like tangible needs on things, stuff like that. Somebody's moving. They want to know if you still got that truck. I tell them I know somebody that does have one.
So, Matt, when would you call in a deacon?
Just had a family that had a baby, and they live a little bit further out. And I thought, hey, are we set up to make sure they're taken care of with any, you know, yard situation or things like that? You know, just touching base with my guy, with Douglas, trying to figure that out.
Same for you, Will.
Yeah, tangible, practical needs. Because I mean, it's great I want them to know, again, it's not just me, whether I can call in Nye Allen, my deacon, or a prayer coordinator, female to get involved. I think that's helpful because I want them to understand there's a lot of people here, a lot of resources that we can bring to bear on what they need.
Part of it is knowing, you talk about trellis and vine, Christ Covenant has a lot of trellises and a big garden. I mean, it's tough to get your arms around it and figure out how they're all connected. And so some of it's just learning what's around, going to different things, and just exposing yourself to, you know, different parts that are happening, going to a service project, meeting folks, stuff like that. Just being out among the people.
I think it can also depend on your community. I know some of the deacons that serve the seniors, you know, they're going to get called a lot more on home repairs and situations that widows are going to run into, like fraud and things that affect elderly people. And most of the families in my elder shepherding groups are younger, so it's more like, yeah, meals for healthcare issues or new babies, and the shepherdesses generally take care of that. But
you get hands-on only when? I mean, or do you just say, okay, they need a contractor? I know a contractor. I'll give them the number, and they can call a contractor. Do you call a contractor, and you go out and assess?
I've done both. It depends. I've called contractors before because I had one situation with a widow who needed – she tried a couple contractors to get a roof repair, and you know they were untrustworthy, or they came and she just didn't believe the quotes were good. So I made a few phone calls and got some contractors out there. It's very situation specific.
Okay. We have a list that we maintain as a group. We made it years ago. I think Greg Verrett put it all together. We called it Greg's List, and it was all the contractors that we've used that were reputable, that we could trust. And we got organized plumbers, electricians, painters, whatever. And we try to and if you use somebody new, we ask you to put it on the list. And if you use somebody on the list and they're a bum, put a note or scratch them. We know we try to maintain it the best we can. Because Christ Covenant has generally got a lot of people that know how to do pivot tables and not a lot of people that know how to change out the capacitor on a heat pump. That's just the community we're in. People are more, you know, keyboarders than carpenters, so we're generally referring people to contractors for making repairs. We've got some good contractors in our congregation that do handyman work and other trades as well that we like to refer to people. But as a deacon, you don't have to go out there and, you know, rewire the bad circuit in their house yourself unless you feel so inclined. You can get them hooked up with somebody. And if they got the money to pay a contractor, most of them are happy. And if they don't have the money, then we can usually help with that as well. So there's not one size fits all. It just depends on the situation.
So guys, you know, one thing comes to my mind is about 3-4 times a year, my pastoral community, so me, all my elders, their wives, deacons, their wives, we try to have a pastoral community lunch. And you guys have, most of you have been probably part of that as a member of somebody else's community. But, you know, we're just trying to foster relationships, trying to provide opportunities for people to get together so that it's helpful to me. I get to see the people who are in my community, and the elders do, and the deacons do. So you're also taking steps to try to cultivate those relationships too, as much as you can.
The commuter suburban church with the 9-to-5 professionals, it is a challenge to make regular contact so that you can build a trust-based relationship. And I don't know a way around it other than to go to them and meet with them. You know, it's hard.
We've had some lunches here after church with just our group and maybe one other elder, and they've been decently attended.
Yeah.
We tried Zoom calls, and that was a miserable failure, and I'm glad it died. So don't try that. But the smaller lunches were pretty good.
Okay, I think we have time for one last question. At least I have time for one. anybody got one?
I don't know. I never heard that this was a commuter church. That's the first time I've ever heard that.
I say meaning, well, I interviewed someone that's from Concord this morning. They're joining the church. I interviewed a guy last week from Fort Mill who's coming to the church. There are people that drive an hour to get here.
Lake Norman.
Lake Norman. Just if you live in Pineville, you're commuting, right? So it's just the nature of the beast.
So what percentage would you say are commuting?
Ooh, that's a good question. I don't know that. I guess I look at it, when I say commuter, I mean if I want to go meet with one of the members, we're not around the corner from each other.
Yeah.
So there's not these clusters. So if we had it organized in a way where we could see where people were, so they can say, hey, you know what, John, you live over in Pineville. I know someone in Steel Creek. Could you meet up with them?
Yeah.
You know, and software people and spreadsheet people, if we could get that together, we could help each other, right?
We tried that already once.
Did we? Keep working on it.
Anyway. You know, the reality of the dynamics of the church is that, you know, every twice a year we're adding 60, 80, 100 people. Yeah. So that's why we need elders and deacons.
And we're adding 3 elders and 10 deacons and stuff.
Yeah.
This is a little narrower as a question, but normally one day if I work as a pastor or as a teaching elder, how would I best encourage officers that just, you know, month to month, year to year, as you serve for a whole time, how do you think pastors or full-time kind of employees in the church can help to get alongside and encourage those that they're in ministry?
I'll say at the beginning of the year, the church here, Tom sent out an email asking deacons to have lunch with him. And just going to lunch with Tom, spending an hour with him and 3 other deacons and having a conversation, learning about each other's lives, that was great. That was a really just a good opportunity to spend some quality time and learn more about each other's lives, get to know Tom. He got to know us, so that was really, that was a really good thing.
I hear here to that.
It seems to me there's still a tendency for members to want to go to the pastors because they're the ones that are visible. I think it's a fine line to sit down with a member and say, hey, we need to build a relationship, and you know, this is part of how the church works, right? And you're in a position to say, you know, you can't preach Acts 20 to them and say, this is what our relationship should look like. It's got to work, but they also need to be educated in that, right? So preaching through how do they live together? How do elders and members minister with one another and to one another? And what does that look like biblically? You know, the Acts 20s, the 1 Timothy 3, and, you know, all the ones where they're hanging on each other and loving each other, the Hebrews passages, all those are just great because it's, I think there is some, I hear a lot of elders talk about just the not getting response, right? And it's tough. And you feel like, am I helping them? Is this the right call? And so I think there's an expectation of that too. It's kind of a prophetic job in that you're called to the office, not necessarily for the end result. You don't know what the end results are going to be, right? And so you kind of have to get your head around that too.
I like the client-supplier relationship. You only get a call when they have a need. If you call them, they're bothered.
Yeah. Ben, I'd add this, and it's not a criticism of what's happening at Christ Covenant, but just to answer the question, in a church our size, for Kevin to be involved in discipling and encouraging the staff, for the staff, the pastors, to be involved in discipling and encouraging their 4, 6, 8 elders, so that they feel fed, they feel noticed, they feel appreciated, so that they in turn, as they're ministering to their elder shepherding group and other people they know, just to not overlook that step. Again, a smaller church that has a senior pastor and 6 elders, then it's senior pastor investing in the 6 elders, so they in turn can be just a biblical model of what Christ did with the apostles, the disciples, and I think that's important.
If my job is to smell like sheep, his job is to smell like elders, right? And so being with them and you know, just being in them and with them and around them.
Brothers, thanks so much for your time. Yes. I think you guys would be open if these guys had a further question, they could email you or something.
Sure.
All right.
Yeah.